From the Sky News Centre at 5. Families of the victims of 7/7 say the Home Secretary needs to review the whole operation of the security services. It's after the judge at the inquest into the 52 deaths criticised MI5 for failing to show a clear photograph of the ringleader of the bombings to an informant. Graham Fookes lost his son in the attacks and says the security services have lessons to learn.
In the report at one stage, the judge says that the security services' attitude and their handling of the data was dreadful. That's an unprecedented attack by a senior judge on the security service.
If the local election results have been bad for the Liberal Democrats, they've been amazing for the Scottish National Party. The SNP now has a majority of seats in the Scottish Parliament, most of them gained from the Lib Dems and Labour. Scottish Labour leader Ian Gray is to step down in the autumn following his party's defeat. It's not all been bad news for Labour, though. In Wales, they have 30 seats in the Cardiff Assembly, just one short of what they needed for overall control. Well, the Liberal Democrats did take a big knock, and there have been calls for the leader, Nick Clegg, to step down. But the former leadership contender Chris Huhne has given him his backing.
When you have a complex set of elections like this, you sit down and take stock and you don't shoot from the hip in terms of reactions. But I don't think that there's any question of Nick's leadership being called into question.
Four men have pleaded guilty to offences linked to a major worldwide internet child porn ring. More than 1,300 people from 45 countries used a website to access millions of child abuse images. There's concern over the health of legendary golfer Seve Ballesteros. His family say he suffered a severe deterioration in his neurological condition. And former Spice Girl Emma Bunton has given birth to a boy. The singer is said to be over the moon with baby Tate. A statement from the star and her partner Jay Jones thanks everyone for their good wishes. That's the latest. I'm Clemency Norris.
Hello, Bristol, no longer a Lib Dem city. And welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. I'm joined this week of the local elections and alternative vote referendum by a leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, just re-elected as councillor for Whitchurch Park, Helen Holland. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we go in depth on Libya and hear two shocking corrupt motives not touched on much by Britain's TV or newspapers for our NATO armed forces attempt to kill Colonel Gaddafi and help Al-Qaeda rebels in Libya's bloody civil war. And is Tesco's set to take over Britain, selling us everything we eat, everything we wear, all our fuel, all our insurance? And Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth is here, explaining that as Tesco's gradually expands, every little hurts the community. And it's that heady hotbed of radical politics that challenges the status quo every year. Bristol's Anarchist Book Fair takes place tomorrow at Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. No doubt the undercover police will be there, but will you? We hear from two of tomorrow afternoon's speakers. And delayed from last week, we also look at emergency planners' provision of potassium iodate tablets. These are one of the most important indications of preparedness for nuclear fallout from other parts of the world or terror attacks on one of our nearby nuclear power stations. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and some heavy showers expected overnight at last, because the ground is rather dry. And isn't it nice to have the showers at night time rather than a day? This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, wetter on Saturday and some rain possibly on Sunday too, with sunny spells. Next week, highs up to 20 Celsius, plenty of sun this week, but also the possibility of a few showers. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of May, highs of 16 Celsius, a little cooler, mixture of sunny spells and showers. Sounds like April's come late. This was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. On to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is the leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, just re-elected as councillor for Whitchurch Park by you yesterday. That's Helen Holland. Hi, Helen, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, were you nervous you might lose your seat yesterday?
Well, believe it or not, I was, which when you now look at the results is astonishing, because I am absolutely thrilled to say that I actually got over 50% of the vote in my ward, which and my majority went up by over 300, which was, I think, a fantastic result. But I think any candidate that doesn't tell you that they're nervous is fibbing. So, yes, I was nervous and I worked hard and I wanted to get every single vote that I could.
Now, I'm just looking at the results here on the City Council website, and I see that there was only 35.2% voted in your ward. That's not very good, is it?
It isn't very good. I suppose you could say it's not as bad as some, but that isn't a good thing either. But
yeah, I mean, there are some as low as 30%, but I mean, even so, it's only roughly one in three people voting.
It is, and that isn't good enough. And of course, the thing is that the nearer you get to election day, the more you're focusing on the people who you know are going to vote, without giving you all the trade secrets of how we run our elections. And so you tend not to, the closer to election day, you tend not to hear the voices of the people who aren't going to bother. But then when you walk down a street and you're going to the places where you know that your vote is, you do often think, well, who's behind those doors that we're walking past that we're not engaging with? And I think that we all, as politicians, as councillors, have to find other ways of reaching people and actually getting people to recognise what the politics bit of their everyday lives is, because I think that that's what's missing.
Well, you haven't had to really work too hard though to do well in Bristol, because the national political scene means that quite a lot of people in the city are annoyed with the Lib Dems, and they're punishing them through the local elections.
Well, I don't think if you spoke to my colleagues, you'd hear them say that they haven't really had to work too hard, because I think one of the things that is very noticeable about the Bristol results this time is that whereas, you know, in Bristol for the last few elections we've had some very, very tight margins. In fact, last year we had one that was in the end was drawn by lots, because they couldn't make it was an equal vote for the Labour and Conservative candidate in Avonmouth, and we've had some very, very small majorities. Actually, now there are a number of my colleagues, and to be fair to the other parties, some of them as well, who have got majorities in the hundreds rather than, you know, just scraping through. And I do think that people have worked very, very hard for the vote. And also, I mean, I know Labour councillors know better than most, really, after the last 13 years and certainly since the Iraq war, about having to pay locally for your national party's, you know, mistakes and failings. There's also quite a fine line between what's the local and what's the national impact, and why people vote in the way that they do.
Now, you have gained, I'm just counting down here, 1, 2, 3, 4, all from the Liberal Democrats.
We have, and that's great news. And with the Green gain, that means that the Liberal Democrats lost 5 seats, and so they're under that finishing line of 35 seats now, and so they've lost an overall majority on the council.
So, but the Greens are inching along behind you, aren't they? And in fact, now they've got 2 councillors in the city, that gives them party status, doesn't
it? That's right.
And they've
yes.
really done very well in a ward, Ashley Ward, where really you should have been expected to pinch this seat off the Lib Dems if anyone was going to.
Well, I think if you look at the Ashley results, and we worked very hard again, Labour hasn't done well in Ashley over the last few years. We had an excellent candidate who I'm sure everybody who met Thangham will agree that one day she will be a great addition to the City Council. I hope that that day will come soon. And we know that the Lib Dems had to work very hard, very much harder than they've worked in previous years, in order to, you know, try and keep their vote up in Ashley. So it was a bit of a three-way fight, I think, between us, the Lib Dems and the Greens, and the other parties absolutely nowhere near.
So what happens now? Are you going to have to, sit down with Barbara Jenk and make some negotiations, or are the Conservatives and the Greens going to be involved too?
Well, the first thing that will happen, of course, is that after any elections, all of the parties have their own internal meetings, and those, generally speaking, will take place over the weekend. I know ours does, and the Lib Dems does. I'm not sure about what the Tories do, and obviously for the Greens, their group now of two, it's easy to get two people together. So those discussions haven't taken place yet, and people remember we're up literally all night long. The results weren't till didn't finish till 7 o'clock this morning, so I think people have been a bit tired for those discussions tonight. But if the council's annual meeting is a week on Tuesday on May the 17th, and hopefully people will you know, be able to put forward what's going to happen at that meeting.
So the two largest parties are you and the Lib Dems, but what do you think, I mean, maybe the Conservatives are now in a position, or possibly even the Greens as well, to actually come to either of those two parties and hold the balance of power?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things about the way that the local election system works. You know, you get the council that the electorate deals you, and I think politicians and councillors have to be mature enough to make sure that they don't do the sorts of, you know, ding-dongs and hiatus that we had some years back in Bristol when it was, you know, it looked as if it was impossible for the city to work out how to govern itself.
Yeah, well, it took months and months, didn't it, to actually agree on an administration. So can you give us any guarantees that's not going to happen this
time?
Well,
I don't think it will happen, and the reason is because I think all councillors were tarred with that brush that time, which is quite a few years ago now. I think that was 2003 from memory. They were all tarred, or we were all tarred with that brush, that, you know, we needed to grow up a bit, bang our heads together and work it out. Because people, I think the big fear is, while you're doing that, you know, that people are losing confidence in your city, and the cities are very competitive these days, and you can't afford to do that.
Now, Bristol Labour Party, fair play to you, have done very well last night. What do you think with the issues uppermost, the local issues in people's mind, when they swung from the Lib Dems over to Labour?
Well, I think, as you say, you know, there was an element of the national issues, and that was about trust, about what the Lib Dems had gone to the country last year saying that they were going to do. You know, every one of the candidates with a photograph, with a pledge card that they wouldn't put up tuition fees, and then doing it. And then that was reflected very much at the local level about, again, things that they'd said that they'd do, like the Area Green Space Plan, which I'm sure you've talked about on your programme before, where they said that they were going to listen to people, and despite very, very energetic campaigns in all sorts of different parts of the city, people springing up to protect green spaces that almost, you know, other people hadn't realised were there, and active groups. I've got one in my own ward who are looking now at one of the green spaces that's under threat, and people just not being able to understand why the case for one space had been made but the case for another hadn't. And so I think that you know, that trust thing was a national issue for the Lib Dems, but that was reflected as well at local level.
Now, Marina Morris is here joining us, and she's got a summary of what went on in the election counts last night and yesterday's local elections.
Hello. Yesterday's elections have changed the political map of the Bristol City Council. Bristol reflected national trends with the vengeance of the voter falling on the Liberal Democrats, who lost absolute council control. 24 local council seats were contested in yesterday's local council elections. 19 of those seats were held by the current party previously holding the seat. The 5 seats which changed hands were all previously held by the Liberal Democrats. 4 of them went to the Labour Party and 1 to the Green Party. The 5 seats lost by the Liberal Democrats were lost by 3 previous councillors, with 2 more standing down. In 4 of these cases, the Liberal Democrats came second, and in Handrove, they suffered perhaps their biggest default coming third. The 70 seats on Bristol City Council are now allocated as follows. The Liberal Democrats had 38 seats, contested 12 of them, returning 7 councillors, giving them 33 seats. They are still the largest party. The Labour Party had 17 seats, contesting 9 of them and returning 14 councillors, giving them 21 seats, making them the second largest party. The Conservative Party had 14 seats, contested 3 of them and are unchanged. The Green Party had 1 seat, which was not contested, and returned another councillor, giving them 2 seats. What this means is that the Liberal Democrats have lost absolute control of the council, but as the largest party, they can probably continue in power with the support of any of other party. Whatever new power structure emerge from this could last for the next 2 years, because there are no local council election in Bristol next year.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, I'm still puzzling slightly over the maths of all this. Helen Holland, Labour leader on Bristol City Council. Not of Bristol City Council yet, anyway, but, sorry, of the Labour group. How does this all stack up? Because it looks to me as if, really, in order to have a coalition, you are going to have to make deals with the Conservatives and the Greens, or certainly just the Conservatives, which doesn't sound all that likely.
Well, coalition isn't the only option, is the first thing to say, isn't it? And you might remember that 4 years ago, the Labour group ran the council as a minority administration, and then for a year after that, the Liberal Democrats ran it as a minority. Before we'd run it as a minority, they had. So there has been, I think, probably in Bristol, a bit more of a tendency to have minority administration since 2003, when Labour lost its overall majority for the first time since the 1980s. There's been a bit more of a tendency to have minority administrations rather than coalitions. But as I said, those discussions haven't been had yet, either within the party groups, which obviously any leaders need to have the backing of their group before they go off and have any chats with other leaders. So, you know, that needs to happen over this weekend.
Now, I'm also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, you were out there on the streets going knocking door to door. How did you feel the elections went yesterday?
Well, obviously, as a Labour Party activist, I'm pleased with the results. Just to pick up on something that Helen was saying a minute ago, on this show previously, you've made the case for having all-out council elections once every 4 years. Because one of the problems we're going to have now is that everybody knows that there's only 2 years of whatever we cobble together, and then it'll change again. And there's a constant running election going on in Bristol, as in other cities, which makes it very difficult to make any plans. And if we have, I mean, I believe in other parts of the country they do have, perhaps you can enlighten us on this, they do have this, you know, once for all elections once every 4 years, which means that people then know exactly where they stand. The administration's got 4 years to fulfil its pledges, and if they're no good, they're kicked out at the end of it. Because I think this is, you know, we've got an inbuilt tendency to instability here because of the constant electioneering.
Well, I have to agree with you, actually, Martin, and as you say, both on this show and in lots of other places, I've advocated that Bristol really does need a four-yearly system, and I'll give you a couple of reasons why. One of them, of course, I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? Because we had a good night last night. If Bristol, people who do this kind of thing, you know, for fun, working out the numbers, if Bristol had been all out last night, we would now be in control of the council. So obviously I would say that that was a good thing, and we'd have 4 years to you know, show what we could do, and then at the end of the 4 years we would be, you know, up for election like any other administration, and people would make their own judgment. Sometimes there's a bit of confusion. Some people say, including the Liberal Democrats who are against moving to a four-yearly system, that it wouldn't necessarily give any certainty. But Martin and I have been talking outside about, you know, places where they can work out how you're going to do it when there's been a kind of indecisive election. And the fact is, you wouldn't necessarily get a majority administration, although we would have done if it was on last night's figures, but you get an administration that's there for 4 years. So if you look at our surrounding authorities, South Gloucestershire and Baines, 4 years ago, they were both minority Tory administrations, which have both lasted for all of the 4 years of you know, in between elections. So
and
people,
they have this four-yearly cycle,
and they and our neighbours do have a four-yearly cycle, which I also think actually disadvantages Bristol, because on things that we do jointly, they're all looking at Bristol because they're going, oh, you know, God, they've got an election coming up next year. So I don't think that it's the big problem. In fact, I think it would be great. And if we get an elected mayor in Bristol, which is another thing that's being thrown into the mix by the coalition government, I think it would be a nonsense to have an elected mayor who was elected on a four-yearly cycle with elections by thirds of the council who the elected mayor would have to work with.
But don't you think on the side of the voters, it's actually quite nice from the voters' point of view, because they get a chance to, in a way, veto or get rid of an administration that they're not happy with every year, apart from 1 year in four, like next year, where we don't have elections. And it actually keeps the politicians on their toes.
Well, I think from the point of view of the parties, you know, keeping the party machine running, you're right. But I don't agree about voters because, you know, yesterday we had people in Bristol North West ringing to find out why they hadn't got elections, because obviously it's a very, very confusing system. It's never the same two-thirds of the city. And I just think that the other thing is that the maths don't normally stack up. Quite often, by the third system, it wouldn't be possible to get rid of the administration, even if all of the seats changed hands. So it doesn't necessarily follow.
Martin, what ward were you campaigning in, and what happened in your ward locally?
Well, mainly in East Bristol, because I'm a resident of East Bristol, so I campaigned in my own ward of Lawrence Hill for Margaret Hicks, and I was also helping Farouk Chowdhury in Easton, because I live near to Easton. I did do a little bit in Ashley, but not very much. I think in Lawrence Hill in particular, we were very keen to, you know, it's one of the most deprived wards in the city, if not the most deprived ward. You've got all sorts of different communities there, a white working class community that's been there all along, others that have come in over the years, and it was a very good result for the Labour Party to unite those communities in the way that we did, and I think Margaret did a fantastic job.
Right, well, we'll be keeping an eye on you, Helen, and other leaders of the other groups to see how you get on in forming an administration. Let's hope it doesn't drag out for weeks or months like it did whenever it was about 3 or 4 years ago. And just to sum up, we had 5 changes yesterday and last night's counts. Ashley Ward was a green gain with nearly 50% of the vote, of the potential people turned out to vote. In Eastville, that was a Labour gain with 42% roughly turned out to vote. Hengrove was another Labour gain, and that was about 40% of people turned out to vote there. Lawrence Hill, which is the ward we're in here, our studios at the City Academy, that was another Labour gain, and that was 36.25% of the voters turned out. And St George West was another Labour gain with 38% of people turning out to vote.
Can I just make a comment about the Green in Ashley? Gus Hoyt, I think it is, who won, he obviously campaigned against Tesco's, and we've had the so-called riot and all the things that went on around that, which we've talked about on this programme. I think that was a very clear indication of what the local community in that ward thinks about Tesco's and about what happened over the last few weeks. It's a very strong signal.
Can I just make one other point, Tony, which is separate from that point, although I think, you know, you would... Had you been at the declarations last night, you would see that, you know, the candidates congratulated one another on the campaign that had been run in Ashley. But the other thing to say is that it is a bit surprising, isn't it, that the Tories haven't made any gains in Bristol. You know, they historically, they talk about targeting and that they are trying to gain more seats, but they found it very, very difficult to do it. And there were a couple of seats where I think the Tories were targeting the Lib Dems yesterday and had been doing for the last month or so, but they signally failed to crack that, you know, those 14 seats that they've got at the moment.
Yeah, but these local elections are very much like by-elections, aren't they, for MPs? If an MP stands down or whatever, or is arrested, as they are sometimes these days, where it's the opposition groups that tend to do well. Whoever's in the opposition parties, they tend to do well in by-elections and in local elections. But yes, I think this is quite... What are your thoughts, finally, before we move on to talk about Bin Laden, on this Ashley Ward gain by the Greens and the whole Tesco issue, Helen, because it seems that there is a genuine feeling in that part of the city that there's been a bit of a democratic deficit and that the Liberal Democrats have just simply failed to deal with this issue. They've been holding up their hands saying, oh, there's nothing we can do.
Well, I don't know if it's the... I think that you're right that communication has been very, very poor. I think one of the big problems is that the planning system allowed Tesco's to be able to get, allowed the comedy club to be able to get a planning permission without it being apparent to the community who the kind of end user of that planning permission was. And that is bound to cause all sorts of suspicion and difficulties. I don't think, though, that the, you know, what we ended up seeing in the media, which probably isn't most people's experience of what was actually going on. I mean, that is a very, very poor image for Bristol, and it's not all about image, but that's a very poor message that goes out. But it does show that people want to have more say in what goes on in their community.
Okay, so no doubt the big story of the week is the supposed killing of former US secret agent turned US bogeyman Osama bin Laden. But the journalism in the United States has not been as rigorous as it should have been.
President Obama speaking from the East Room of the White House, telling the nation and the world President Obama is in fact dead. It was a U.S.-led strategic, Osama bin Laden is dead.
He unveiled details that have never before been heard about how Obama was killed and what led to the American forces finding out where he was.
So Obama bin Laden, terror mastermind, is reported dead.
Obama bin Laden, terror mastermind, is reported dead. Well, this is a few mistakes there from the American television coverage of the killing of Osama bin Laden. Let's start with you, Martin. First of all, do you actually believe that Osama bin Laden has been killed? Because there's actually been doubt thrown on the veracity of these reports.
Well, let's put it this way. I read the Pakistani English language press, Dawn, Daily Jang. It's only read by the educated classes in Pakistan, the sort of military officers and journalists and teachers and so on. Frankly, people in Pakistan don't believe a word the American government says. Whether they did or did not kill bin Laden, they haven't convinced the people of Pakistan, that's for sure. And of course, if you look back to the incident a few weeks ago where the CIA guy was arrested having shot dead two motorcyclists at a intersection.
This is Raymond Davis.
Raymond Davis, yes, from the Kinks, that one.
Well, he had the same name as the
same
guy
name
from
as the guy from the Kinks, yes. The fact is that the educated opinion in Pakistan is of the opinion that the West is in fact fomenting terrorism inside Pakistan. Now, that may not be true. That may be paranoia on the part of the Pakistani elite, if you like. But that is a problem that the Americans have got. And if you don't produce a body or DNA or a photograph, you invite ridicule, frankly.
Helen, what are your thoughts about this news which came out? We had the royal wedding on Friday, didn't we? We had the killing of Gaddafi's son and three grandchildren on Saturday. It was quite a busy weekend. And then this raid by the US Navy SEALs and Osama bin Laden apparently killed on the Sunday. But what are your thoughts about the principle of what the Americans were up to there? I mean, without telling the Pakistanis, and do you actually believe the story we've been told by the White House and the Pentagon?
Well, it's an extraordinary one, isn't it? And first of all, I have to say that I feel extremely uncomfortable. You know, other terrorist leaders, if that's what you want to call Osama bin Laden, are brought to justice, and a sort of summary justice of going in and killing somebody without a war crimes trial or any other sort of trial does not seem to me to be something that is how the West ought to be showing the rest of the world how we do things. And I do think that the longer it goes on that it can't be proved that he was there, I think we're in a very, very extraordinary situation, and I'm deeply uncomfortable with not bringing people to trial.
But of course, the Americans would say, wouldn't they, that, well, the Pakistanis, he's been living under their nose for all this time. We had to do something.
Well, that's right, that's what they would say, but that's the other thing that makes it more extraordinary. I mean, the more you don't have to think about this for very long to think, well, you know, was he really there? Could it really be that he could have been living there without people knowing he was there? There were some other stories, without going into, you know, into the kind of conspiracy theorists, that there were some stories that I picked up, you know, on the news yesterday as I was driving round, about, you know, how long he'd been there, whether he'd been contained in a room, whether he'd been brought into that compound. I just think that we really, really need to know the facts, and the longer that the Americans don't tell us what the facts are, the more the conspiracy theorists and those of us who just think, well, this doesn't seem to add up, are going to be perplexed.
Well, from what you're saying there, you're quite right, because midweek there were doubts over whether proof would be released in the United States that bin Laden had indeed been killed. But President Obama decided, or was told to decide, against it.
There is no doubt that we killed Osama bin Laden. It is important for us to make sure that very graphic photos of somebody who was shot in the head are not floating around as an incitement to additional violence, as a propaganda tool.
Martin, President Obama there talking about these photos possibly floating around. Can you not understand why the Americans didn't want to release these photos? They would incite more violence.
I'd just like to reiterate what Helen said earlier. Why can't you put him on trial? I mean, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was supposed to be put on trial in New York, and they've now backed off from that. Because, of course, trials bring out evidence, and evidence may point to all sorts of directions for people who are actually responsible for the attacks in 9/11. And that's why we have a police force. In Northern Ireland, when Ronnie Kerr, the police officer, was killed the other week, the whole community united in support of the police service of Northern Ireland, and that's because the police lead the fight against terrorism, because they do it by the book, and they chase down whoever's responsible. It might be a British Army general who's responsible, for example, like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's actually hiding out in Iraq, although he's been chased by the British police for years. Now, that's what you need, is everybody to have confidence in police action carried out transparently, under democratic accountability, and everybody gets their day in court. And that's not what we've seen here, is it?
But going back to my original point, if these photographs of bin Laden had been released, surely this is just going to cause mayhem around the world.
Well, if you go around shooting people in the head, that's a crime, isn't it? And you know, you're not supposed to shoot people in the head, but it's not even sure that he's guilty. Yeah. So first of all, you shoot somebody in the head, that's a crime. Under Pakistani law, that's a crime. When Raymond Davis shot two people at that intersection a few weeks ago, that was a crime. He got out of the car, finished the people off, and then took photographs of them and got back in the car. The Americans tried to claim he was a diplomat and had diplomatic immunity. Eventually, the family were paid off. But on his mobile phone, they found contacts with all the top terrorist leaders in Pakistan. That's all in the Pakistani media. It hasn't been on Radio 4. And what we've now got in the internet age is there's an English language media out there that isn't controlled by the West. Russia Today, Press TV, Pakistani newspapers. And if people want to, they can find out very different views about what's going on from the ones we are fed as a normal diet here.
But it's a bit nerve-wracking, isn't it, having the Americans falling out with the Pakistanis in this way, because Pakistan is the only Muslim nuclear power.
Well, I think what's very interesting about this, and of course this is only speculation at this stage, it was right next to the Pakistani version of Sandhurst where all this took place. And because of all the fuss over Raymond Davis a few weeks ago, I think a message is being sent to the Pakistani military by the US military. Don't forget, underlying all of this is a Chinese desire to build an oil pipeline from Karachi into Western China, which will allow oil to flow into Western China to industrialise Western China. Western policy is to frustrate that. That implies destabilisation of Pakistan. And that is what is being openly talked about by military officers in Pakistan. So it could well be that we're going to have a fight between the Americans and the Pakistani army.
Well, Marina Morris has been busy this week. She's been out on the streets to find out whether you believe the Pentagon and White House when they say Osama bin Laden has been killed.
Was Osama bin Laden really killed last weekend?
Well, I have no reason to not believe, so I think he has been killed, yes.
Yeah, I do.
I don't.
Do you not?
No.
Well, that's another thing. I thought they might have killed a double.
I'm speaking for myself. I think American government is the biggest terrorist of them all. So, and I wouldn't believe a word they says. Unless they show me the body or I see it, then I'll believe it.
Yeah, I would like to see a body. I believe he's dead, but, you know, it'd be not really reassuring without seeing a body.
It's impossible to tell, you know. News reports are there for the general public, you know, their form of media, and obviously sometimes their propaganda. It's impossible to know for sure if he was really killed.
Yeah, I think he was, but I think the word terrorist was just made up for us to be afraid and for a reason for us to go to war. There's no such thing as a terrorist.
Yeah, no doubt he was killed, yeah.
I don't think so, no.
Well, certainly a mixed response there, and I think we can pretty positively say Bristol is unconvinced about this story. Helen, it's a bit worrying, isn't it, when we're being told these, you know, given a whole story like this, and yet we can't actually necessarily believe it.
Well, it is, isn't it? And conveniently, of course, the body is said to have been disposed of at sea, which presumably means that, you know, we will never know whether or not it was. I did notice that there was one media report earlier in the week where whoever it was who was speaking actually tripped up to say that he was shot in the face, not the head. I mean, obviously, then if that was the case, you wouldn't be able to recognise somebody from the photographs. I go back to the point that, you know, if the special forces were able to get in there, then surely they were able to capture him and bring him out, and then he would have been able to be put up on trial.
Yeah, the story's been changing daily almost for coming out of the Pentagon and the White House. One of the stories was originally that there was a massive firefight going on in the compound, and then we hear that actually only one of the people other than the Navy SEALs was actually shooting at all, and only one person was armed, which it's a bit of strange to see the story morphing. Martin, do you want to just finalise and sum up on this one?
Well, I think this is an ongoing issue. I mean, basically the US government and the British government got a massive credibility problem. They've been shown to lie about all sorts of things, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq just being the most obvious one. Now, the point is that once you are a liar, your testimony in a court of law, for example, is invalid. Yeah, once you've been shown to lie about one thing. And I'm afraid out there in the big wide world, in Colombia, where I visited 5 years ago, for example, people simply don't believe a word they say.
Well, that's a great pity. So what can we do about all this, Martin? Come on.
Well, we've got to go to back to the rule of law. Yeah, the rule book. Everybody's got to obey the rules. Terrorism is wrong, violence is wrong, and the police have got to get on top of whoever's doing it, no matter how high and mighty they may be. And there's got to be one rule of law for everybody.
OK, on to our next story. And a taxpayer-backed Lloyds Bank has plunged back into the red with not a little bit of money in the red, but $3.5 billion loss after setting aside billions for insurance compensation claims. And this is from the Daily Mail. And the bank's shares, that is Lloyds, tumbled 5% this morning. Part nationalised Lloyds Banking Group fell back into the red after it was set aside £3.2 billion to cover payment protection insurance mis-selling. Helen?
Well, I mean, you can see when you read this why the banks fought so hard against the case, against compensation for mis-selling of payment protection, can't you? I mean, the cost of it will be enormous, and it's money that they haven't factored into having to give back, and it's money that a lot of us, I'm sure, that we're all in the same boat. You know, we've had credit card protection that we probably don't need. We've had payment protection when we've taken loans out or hire purchase on anything. And everybody, every website is telling people how to claim this money back, quite rightly. And it just shows, I'm afraid, some of the sharp practices of some of the major finance.
But it's not the first time, is it, that we've had the banks being the naughty boys in the news?
Absolutely.
Why is it that the banks just seem to be? I mean, they've clearly here made a calculated gamble that they can missell this stuff and nobody's going to notice.
Well, and also, you know, they carried on fighting it to the bitter end, and they say that they are going to carry on fighting it. And those kind of law cases, legal cases, are very, very expensive. So they're spending money, some of which, of course, we've given them through tax,
the
government bailout, in order to fight actually being able to give us our money back. And I mean, my own experience is that when we challenged, I think it was when we made an early payoff to a loan, and we challenged because they put a charge on it. You challenge the bank and straight away, oh yes, no, you're right, we shouldn't have done that, and they do cough up. But quite honestly, this was just a way license to print money, really, for the banks.
Martin?
Yeah, well, actually I did a bit of research about this for Bristol Debt Advice Centre a few years ago. And the way in which the payment protection insurance mis-selling was done is that what it says in the small print is that if you are self-employed or of anything of that nature, then you're not going to get the money. You know, it's only if you're made unemployed from a full-time job. Yeah, so loads of people were taking out these things on the understanding that they were being payment protection, but in fact they weren't getting payment protection.
But they almost always weren't taking them out in a positive way, where they're just being told, if yes, you have this loan, yeah, that's the extra.
But I mean, it sounded like a sensible thing to do, yeah. Especially if you're self-employed. You think, oh, I'll do that, because then if I do default, then I'll get that. I'll be protected. In fact, I actually got a payout on the payment protection insurance when I was made redundant from Bristol City Council, because I was made redundant from a proper job, and they actually paid out on the loan. You know, they basically paid off the interest on the loan for 12 months. So I was actually a winner on that one. But underlying all of this, I would like to say, is when the banks are supposedly making profits, not Lloyds, who are making a loss here, those profits are based on Enron-style accounting. If they were actually to mark to market all the junk that they hold, then they're not making profits at all. So what's actually going on is what's called technically a control fraud. The people in charge of the banks are running out paper profits, which means they can pay out bonuses and share dividend payments on shares to the owners. But of course, the banks are in fact bust. They've been bust all along.
Helen, the Lloyds is one of these banks which we own. Now, a majority shareholding in. So why haven't the Labour Party, certainly Labour was in, who was in power up until this time last year, actually put in place directors of these banks who do what the public want? And clearly the public do not want them to be fighting cases like this. They want them to be honest and upfront.
Well, why haven't they? You're right. And whilst I'm somebody who does support that the banks were bailed out because ordinary people would have lost their savings, would have lost their mortgages, that would have been a real crisis had the banks gone down, I do think that, you know, rather late in the day, people have woken up to the fact that they kind of almost signed a blank cheque and didn't put enough, you know, strings attached to the bailout, and we do not seem as a government or as a country to have the controls over these banks, which are largely, as you say, owned by us, the taxpayers. We don't seem to have the controls to then get them to do what we want them to do. This is one case. Obviously, the bonuses is another, and I know that MPs on the Treasury Select Committee, or Finance Select Committee, have raised these points, and you know, it's all kind of up in the air again. But meanwhile, these cases go on.
But I mean, you could call them chances if you were being kind. If you weren't being quite so kind, you'd call them con men. And just also to let people know that if you do have a PPI complaint, that is Payment Protection Insurance complaint, there is a phone number which I'll read out: 0845300559, and I'll give that number again in a minute. And you can literally get in touch with Lloyds TSB with any people who think they may have been mis-selled this payment protection insurance. That number's 0845300559.
Can I just add that it was the last Labour government that outlawed payment protection insurance mis-selling?
Okay. They shot that fast. You will also find on some, you know, finance advice websites, you'll find model letters that you can use to do it. Because of course, the other thing that is likely to happen here is yet another scam on top of another one. Is you will find people offering to reclaim it for you and taking a cut of your money.
Okay. Now, also, just before the end of the hour, just before we come up to 6 o'clock, I'll read out that number again in a few minutes if you didn't have a pen handy. Now, on to our next story. 235 people apply for a job as a butcher's apprentice. And this is from the Daily Mirror yesterday. A butcher who advertised for an apprentice got 235 applications from desperate job seekers, including lawyers and surveyors. Doug Ewens, who's 43 years old, said he was overwhelmed by the level of interest, especially as he was only paying just above the minimum wage. He said, "We've been flabbergasted. There were people with a lot of qualifications who'd never worked in a butcher's before, graduates, solicitors, surveyors, not the kind of people you'd expect." I was looking at the job pages on the Evening Post yesterday, Helen, Wednesday this week. Literally only two pages of jobs where there used to be about 10. So this is hardly surprising, but what can we do about it? The fact that there just are so many people, in this case 235, chasing every job.
Well, it's frightening, isn't it, to look at the way that unemployment is rising, and particularly unemployment amongst young people, where one in five young people now is out of work. And when you get unemployed older people who've got life experience, even if it's completely unrelated to the trade in hand, who are going to go for these kind of jobs, then those jobs are not going to be there for young people. I was pleased to see that the butcher has actually now decided to take on two apprentices, and one of the things that the Labour group has been doing is to back the call that the Bristol Partnership has made for Bristol to rise to the challenge of providing 1,000 apprenticeships. It's not enough, but it would go a long way. 1,000 apprenticeships right across the public and private sector, voluntary sector businesses over the next year to give opportunities to those young people. Because those of us who, you know, remember what it was like in the 1980s know that there was a whole lost generation of young people then who were disaffected because they couldn't find jobs, and some of the people who are still out of work with, you know, certainly in my part of the city, there are some families where they haven't worked for you know, several generations haven't worked since people lost jobs at Wills's, for example, when that closed down, then, you know, we know that that has an incredibly profound effect on the family, on a whole range of other measures like educational achievement, health, birth weight, all of those things, teenage pregnancy, smoking, alcohol and substance abuse, all of those things. So actually, being able to hold out some hope for young people, offering these 1,000 apprenticeships, which is what the Bristol Partnership wants to do, and we back that, then I think that that's one of the things that we can be doing.
Is there anything more concrete that your party can do about the fact that we've got so many factories now closing across the city? I was just driving past one earlier on today, completely empty. And, you know, it does seem that the prospect of these, because what's happening is all these businesses are just simply moving abroad.
Well, I mean, I live very close to Brabies, the most recent closure in Bristol, and you know that firm has been part of the furniture, if you like, part of the landscape in Ashton for a long time. It's you know, manufacturing, it's very unique work really, but obviously somebody else is picking up all of those contracts, and they're not going to be those containers aren't going to be made in Bristol any longer, and that's a great shame because a lot of people have lost their jobs.
Well, they'll be probably shipped in from the Far East or something. Martin, is there a vision that we can actually do something with these? I mean, whether it's, I mean, because all that's happening with these old factories is that they're being bulldozed and housing's been put on them, isn't it?
Yeah, well, don't presume that factories are closing because the business is going elsewhere. What may be starting to happen as a recession depression kicks is that factories are closing and not opening up elsewhere because the overall demand in the world economy is faltering. The real problem is a macroeconomic problem. It's once you get mass unemployment established, you then get a vicious cycle where the deficit never comes down because you're paying benefits out, and then of course you've got to cut more to get the deficit down, which doesn't work. The economic policy of the government, the current government, is frankly unsustainable, and the bond market are already signalling amber that they are possibly going to downgrade Britain's national debt as a result of the policies being pursued. So the more cuts are carried through, the worse the situation will get. My sister was made redundant yesterday from the public sector, working in a unit with kids who've been excluded from school, and the public sector is to take, I can't remember, was it 600 or 900,000 redundancies in the next 2 months?
600,000.
600,000. Now, that will lead, according to their own estimates by the government, to more job losses in the private sector, because all of those people, of course, spend money, buy cars, buy holidays, whatever, but they're not going to have the money to spend anymore. And then the economy starts to teeter. And then this is exactly what's happened in Ireland, it's exactly what's happened in Greece and Spain, and there is no way out down that road. And I'm afraid we're not going to change direction until the economy has truly crashed. There's no reason to crash the economy. We could try and avoid it, and frankly, I think if we'd had a Labour government, we wouldn't be in the same situation. On the other hand, even with a Labour government, a dollar collapse and so on, and a collapse of the banks is a pretty big thing. It doesn't matter, you know, you can't just wish that away. But I think that we've got to get back to a proper discussion of economic fundamentals, the stuff I was taught in Oxford University in the 70s, which was thrown in the waste paper basket by Margaret Thatcher. That is the textbook. We need to get it out of the waste paper basket and have another look at it.
So if you were George Osborne, what would you do tomorrow?
We need to invest for the future. And you say, well, that's deficit denial. I'd say, no, there's plenty of money in this country. It's in the hands of the wealthy classes, and it's got to be paid. They've got to pay. In the 1950s, top rate of tax in Britain was 96%. The boys were fighting in Korea. It was that was the way of it. And that, what's happened is basically that the wealthy classes, the city classes, have not paid their fair share of tax
for
generations
now. But if you ask them to pay now, Martin, they're going to be squirreling their money away in tax havens, and they might even leave the country.
Isn't it interesting that most of the tax havens around the world are actually British sovereign possessions? When this happened in France in the 1960s, General de Gaulle, all the money was going into Monaco, so General de Gaulle just surrounded Monaco with police and troops and just said, nobody's coming in and nobody's coming out until you make a deal with us about tax. The German tax police raided Luxembourg about 5 years ago, just turned up in the morning, went straight through the Luxembourg banks and found all the money which had been squirreled there away from the German tax authorities. I think with mass unemployment developing, there's going to be zero tolerance for tax evasion. Absolutely. If we're all in this together, we're all in this together. And I think that those with money better recognise that that's going to be the case.
I think there's an. I mean, there's another obvious thing. You don't have to have an encyclopedic knowledge of economics as Martin has to recognise that the fewer people that there are in work, the less money is being taken from tax and insurance to pay for the rest of the people who aren't in work. So therefore, this drive down of the number of people on benefits, you know, reviews of people's incapacity benefit and so on, that has to go along with what the coalition is doing. Because there just is not going to be enough money in the pot to pay benefits at the level that they are doing. But, and there's going to be more people who actually are eligible for benefits.
Well, I think that the benefit changes are just, class warfare for the sake of it, frankly. I mean, what you want, if you're going to have an economy going into recession, this is called, what they call it in the textbook, automatic stabilisers. If an area, like a mine closes, the benefits system prevents all the small shops from closing. And that means that another investor may come in. But if you don't have a benefit system, as we saw in Eastern Europe where I used to live, no proper benefit system, you just fall straight through the floor and no new investor is going to come in because there's no money in the economy. The welfare system is not a kind of optional add-on or something that we do just because we're soft-hearted. It's an absolutely essential feature of a modern capitalist economy. Well, you've got to have one.
Of course, and one of the questions that I keep asking is who is going to pick up the cost of people who fall through the net in terms of homelessness, in terms of being stopped their benefits? You know, those people have children. Who is going to pick up the cost of those children?
Well, just think of the impacts on crime and then the impacts on the police spending and so on.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, obviously, the cost is going to be much greater and somebody at some point is going to have to pick up that cost.
Well, deep inside today's Evening Post, I've just been rustling through a copy of it here, page 26 today, Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP, is Bristol Labour MP, is saying that the Prime Minister is accused, the headline reads, after refusing to meet disabled campaigners. Prime Minister David Cameron was accused of living in an ivory tower after refusing to meet disabled Bristol campaigners opposing his plans to cut benefits. Bristol's East's Kerry McCarthy challenged him to hold face-to-face talks with the delegation due to head to London next Wednesday in protest over the reductions in support during Prime Minister's questions this week. The Shadow Treasury Minister, that's Kerry, told him constituents with severe disabilities and chronic illnesses were bearing the brunt of this government's attack on welfare benefits and public services. She asked if he had the courage to meet them so he could hear from them at first hand about the devastating impact this callous and uncaring government, that's to quote Kerry, are having on their lives.
Yeah, I think that's interesting about getting people on disability benefit into work, which is the ostensible rationale for the policy, is that most people who are on disability benefit, let's just imagine that they are, not like most of them are, but just for example, somebody who's an alcoholic, yeah? And that's why they're on disability benefit. Which employer is going to employ that person without massive support? And if you're going to give them massive support, you ain't saving yourself any money. The cheapest option is often to just pay people off to vegetate. And it would be an aspiration and a goal for the society to get these people back into work. But you'd have to change the way work is structured. It would involve massive investment in things like ramps and so on, so that disabled people could get access to places of work and so on and so forth. But none of it will save you a penny. And that's like most of the things that the government's doing. In actual fact, most of what they're doing is actually costing money under the guise of saving money.
And I did actually hear a survey, I think it was about a fortnight ago, where they asked employers whether they would be prepared to give somebody, say, a recovering alcoholic or somebody who'd come clean of drugs, a chance in the workplace. And the irony is that on the one hand, you've got the government who are saying that they're going to screw down on people who are getting incapacity benefit because they are dependent on alcohol or drugs, but you've got the majority of the employers who were contacted in that survey said no, they wouldn't be prepared to, because they would find them untrustworthy.
Yeah, and also in the US there's been a survey of companies saying that something like 60-70% of companies are absolutely unprepared to employ anybody who is currently unemployed. Yeah, when you've got 235 people applying for a job, the first thing you do is you get rid of all the people who are currently unemployed.
Okay.
To reduce the shortlist to
six.
Okay,
Helen, what's the Labour Group's deal to get people back to work in this city then? What are you going to do?
Well, as I said, we're backing the Bristol Partnerships call. Well, it's a challenge, really, to get 1,000 apprenticeships in the city. And I think that actually, if we got companies, the City Council has played its part, and I think there's over 100 apprentices within the City Council, and there are many in other sectors. But if we got businesses to actually do this, we could get far more than 1,000 apprentices. And we know that apprenticeships, you know, it isn't like YTS or those things that you know were going on in the 1980s. It's a real route into paid work. The apprentices also need to be paid at the minimum wage or more, preferably. And I know that there is some question about that. But we've got to give hope to that generation.
OK, on to our next story. And parents have been pleading for more urgent action over primary school places in Bristol. That was in Wednesday's Evening Post. And Tuesday's Evening Post, we were told Bristol's set to run out of secondary school places. Helen, what is going on? We've got not enough primary school places and not enough secondary school places.
Well, I mean, the primary school crisis has been known about, but I think that the Lib Dem administration have taken their eye off the ball. They've been very busy bailing out a private school in North Bristol, and I just think that they hadn't recognised that there was a problem in South Bristol. They'd assumed that there was a problem in the area around that school that they knew about, but my colleague Sean Bynan in Southville went to this public meeting that the Evening Post reported there, and there was a great deal of anger from parents there, many of whom, you know, they live in Southville, they live close to the city centre, they haven't got cars, and they were being told to go to schools a couple of miles away where there are no bus routes to those schools. Well, it's totally unrealistic to expect somebody to walk a five-year-old 2 miles, particularly in one case it was along a road that didn't even have a pavement, to go to a school and passing probably three or four other primary schools on the way. And there has been a lack of planning.
But isn't this something that was a problem from past Labour administrations as well, that the Lib Dems have been trying to do something about? You can't completely wash your hands of it.
No, I'm not washing my hands of it. But you can't identify that there's a problem. And we certainly did that when we were in the administration between 2007 and 2009, and start putting measures in place in order to address that problem. And then wake up a couple of years later and find that, oh, you've dealt with it, you know, in one bubble it's popped up and you've been able to deal with it, but in another part of the city you haven't. And actually, one of the other things that has come out of this is that there hasn't really been an open relationship between some of the schools, and some of the schools have got governing bodies who are very, very annoyed to find out that they are being directed to take additional children without actually being given resources to cover.
So what's your solution?
The solution is that you have got to really get to the bottom of these figures. It can't be that difficult, can it, to work out how many children are going to be in each phase and stage of education, and to make sure that you are going to be able to accommodate them, and not just accommodate them anywhere. Parental choice is the name of the game, so you know you have got to be able to meet that parental choice, and you have got to be able to invest in those schools in order to meet that need.
Well, Labour leader, not quite leader of the City Council, but leader of the Labour Group on the City Council, Helen Holland, thanks very much. Now, after the news, we go into depth on Libya and hear not one but two shocking motives, not touched on much by Britain's TV or newspapers, for our and NATO's armed forces' attempt to kill Colonel Gaddafi and also to help al-Qaeda rebels in Libya's bloody civil war. Plus, tomorrow's Anarchist Book Fair. That's coming up after the Sky News at 6.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody